17. Cannibalism in the Pacific Islands. Nothing, it seems to me, is more difficult than to explain to a cannibal why he should give up human flesh. He immediately asks, "Why mustn't I eat it?" And I have never yet been able to find an answer to that question beyond the somewhat unsatisfactory one, "Because you mustn't." However, though logically unconvincing, this reply, when backed by the presence of the police and by vague threats about the government, is generally effective in a much shorter time than one could reasonably anticipate. J. H. P. Murray, Lieutenant Governor, Chief Judicial Officer, British New Guinea, 1912. In the spring of 1985, veterinarians working in the English counties of Sussex and Kent were puzzled when dairy farmers reported that a few of their cows were exhibiting some peculiar symptoms. The normally docile creatures were acting skittish and aggressive. They also exhibited abnormal posture, difficulty standing up and walking, and a general lack of coordination. Most of the cows were put down and sent on to rendering plants, facilities that process dead, often diseased animals into products like grease, tallow, and bone meal. It wasn't until the following year that England's Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries, and Food launched an investigation. According to research biochemist Colm Kelleher, microscope slides were prepared from the brains of stricken cows, and they showed the tissue to be riddled with holes, reminiscent of Swiss cheese. In what would become the first of many unfortunate decisions, the veterinary pathologists who examined the slides blamed the holes on faulty slide preparation. But by November of the following year, researchers knew that the abnormal spaces had once been filled with neurons that had shrunken and died. They also thought that amyloid plaques, the sticky concentrations of a normally non-sticky brain protein, might be a contributing factor to the neuron deaths. The holes and plaques were characteristic of a number of neurological diseases, with sheep scrapie and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, CJD, being the best known of these somewhat mysterious maladies. These and other diseases of their ilk were classified as transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, TSEs, because of the spongy appearance of infected brain tissue. The British researchers soon named their new disease bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE. The press, of course, would need something a bit splashier. They settled on mad cow disease. By 1987, there were over 400 confirmed cases of BSE, which had spread to cattle herds across England. And while scientists looked for puzzle pieces, nervous government officials, who preferred the term bovine scrapie, repeatedly reassured the public that it was safe to eat English beef. And why not, they rationalized, hadn't scrapie been killing sheep for centuries with no harm to the humans who consumed them? Why then should a bovine version of the disease be any different? Other researchers, though, were not so sure, and a few of them began comparing BSE to a disease that had killed humans, thousands of them. To these professionals, this particular affliction was still known by its indigenous name, Kuru, the trembling disease. Like their UK counterparts, the American Media Corps had previously scrambled to coin their own inappropriate names for Kuru. They settled on the laughing death and, alternately, laughing sickness, at a time when being called politically correct meant you had voted for the guy who won. According to the rash of radio, magazine, and newspaper accounts that followed the discovery of Kuru by Western researchers in the 1950s, some of the earliest and most unsettling symptoms of the disease were intermittent bouts of uncontrolled laughter, or what researchers referred to as pathological laughter. But if the symptoms of Kuru were disturbing to the mid-20th century public, the way the disease was said to spread was even worse. For, according to those working to unlock the lethal mystery, Kuru was spread by cannibalism. In the early 1950s, anthropologists and medical researchers began arriving at one of the wildest and most primitive regions on the planet. New Guinea, the world's second largest island, rises from the western Pacific like a dinosaur with a mountainous spinal column. Upon their arrival, the scientists saw no roads, and nothing much that resembled their concept of a city or even a town. Instead, they found themselves crossing parasite-ridden mangrove swamps and rainforests whose primary inhabitants seemed to be biting insects, terrestrial leeches, and venomous snakes. But even after reaching their destination in the foreboding eastern highlands, conditions were no less dangerous, for the researchers had come to study New Guinea's infamous cannibals. Numbering approximately 36,000 individuals in the mid-20th century, the foray spoke three distinct dialects and inhabited some 170 villages situated among New Guinea's lush mountain valleys. Desiring and having little or no contact with the outside world, the foray practiced the same slash-and-burn agriculture that had sustained them for thousands of years. Currently, what made them especially interesting to the researchers was not their lack of contact with the modern world, their farming techniques, or even the reports that they practiced ritual cannibalism. It was the fact that something was killing them, horribly and at an alarmingly rapid rate. A decade earlier, as post-World War II colonialism extended its reach onto the primitive Pacific Islands, Australian patrol officers in New Guinea began encountering some of the most isolated of the island's inhabitants. Like the missionaries that had arrived, preached, and often disappeared for their troubles, the Australian officials, whom the foray called Kiops, encouraged the locals to curtail what they considered some unacceptably bad behavior. Sorcery and tribal warfare, the Aussie officials said, were prohibited. The foray were also requested to please stop eating each other, which they claimed to do as a way of honoring their dead. Grudgingly, the indigenous people soon agreed to the requests, although today many anthropologists believe that, while most of them complied, others simply concealed their long-held rituals whenever the nosy white people came around. Unfortunately, many of the foray were experiencing problems far more serious than the arrival of their pushy new friends. In fact, the Kiops were reporting that something akin to a plague was taking place, one that primarily took its toll on women and children. In addition to the uncontrollable laughter, victims experienced tremors, muscle jerks, and coordination problems that gradually gave way to an inability to swallow, and finally, complete loss of bodily control. The foray responded to their stricken relatives with kindness, feeding, moving, and cleaning them when they could no longer care for themselves. Invariably, though, their loved ones died, all of them, of starvation, thirst, or pneumonia, their bodies covered in bed sores. The mystery disease was killing approximately 1% of the population each year. Foray elders told the foreigners that the sickness resulted from a form of sorcery. The Kiops were informed that the process went something like this. Sorcerers would stealthily obtain an item connected to their intended victim, like feces, hair, or discarded food. After wrapping the object in leaves, they would place it in a swampy area where it couldn't be found. As the sorcery bundle began to decompose, so too, the foray said, would the victim. The elders also told the Kiops that the condition could not be cured or even treated, and they tried to explain that preventing this sort of thing was the main reason they sometimes killed each other. The patrol officers took it all down, and although some of them were quite sympathetic, they drew the line at allowing the foray to resume the killing of suspected sorcerers. These unfortunates were generally men or boys accused without evidence, usually several days after someone in their own village had died of kuru, then hacked, stoned, or bludgeoned to death in a form of ritual murder known as tukabu. It made sense to the Kiops that the best way to stop the killing was to gain an understanding of the mystery ailment, and a number of hypotheses were developed. Initially, it was suggested that the deaths were stress-related and had resulted from the foray making contact with the whites. Others, though, feared that whatever was killing the foray had a more pathological nature. By the time Ronald and Catherine Burnt arrived in the New Guinea Highlands in 1951, they had already spent years in the field studying Australia's Aboriginal communities. The thought was that the foray would become another notch on Ronald's impressive anthropological belt, and at first, things looked promising. the indigenous Highlanders threw parties for the couple, reportedly believing them to be the spirits of their dead ancestors, returning to the fold to relearn the language they had apparently forgotten. Soon enough, though, the foray lost interest in rehabilitating their pale relatives, but not in the strange goods they had brought along with them. Fascination soon turned to envy, and not long after the Burnts settled in, they wrote that the locals were difficult people to deal with, requiring payments for stories, salt, tobacco, newspapers, wool strands, matches, razors, and so on. The anthropologists also reported plenty of cannibalism. "Actually, these people are bestial in many ways," Ronald Burnt wrote. "Dead human flesh to these people is food, or potential food." He also described cannibalism among the foray as an outlet for sexual violence, and "orgiastic feast" was a phrase he seemed to regard with fondness. A decade later, the not-yet-controversial anthropologist Bill Ahrens commented on Ronald Burnt's influential 1962 book on social interactions among the foray. According to Ahrens, Burnt's tome, Excess and Restraint, displayed too much of the former and too little of the latter. Ahrens was particularly galled by Burnt's description of a foray husband copulating with a corpse as the man's wife simultaneously butchered the body for a meal. As these things go, she accidentally cut off her husband's penis with her knife. "Now you have cut off my penis," the man cried. "What shall I do?" In response, according to Burnt, the woman popped it into her mouth and ate it. Ahrens was not alone in his criticism of the Burnts, as others concluded that, while the pair had made some important anthropological contributions, there were more than a few problems with their work. Most of these related to the many instances of outrageous behavior Burnt detailed in his book, coupled with the growing suspicion that he had made much of it up. As I began my own research on cannibalism, I found it odd that the Burnts' reputation, especially as it related to their claims about extreme behavior by the foray, seemed to have recovered quite nicely with the passage of time. In fact, I noticed that the Burnts were cited in many of the more recent papers on Kuru and cannibalism as having presented solid evidence that the foray practiced man-eating. But more on that later. Back in the New Guinea Highlands of 1952, relations between the Burnts and the foray failed to improve during the couple's second field season. Ronald reportedly slept with a pistol under his pillow, at one point firing it to scatter some villagers who had been bothering him. As for Kuru, the Burnts had seen the disease among the foray, but apparently never made any meaningful connections concerning its cause. Within 2 years of their arrival in New Guinea, the pair left the country for good. Fortunately, after the Burnts' inauspicious start, the researchers who followed them had far better luck, some of them initiating studies that would become classics in the fields of anthropology and disease hunting, and eventually garnering a pair of Nobel Prizes. One of the researchers was Daniel Carlton Gajdusek, a Yonkers, New York native and 1946 graduate of Harvard Medical School. Gajdusek had no real interest in practicing medicine, but instead chased his fascination with viral genetics and the anthropology of what he called primitive communities across the world. He studied rabies and plague in the Middle East, hemorrhagic fever in Korea, and encephalitis in the Soviet Union. Arriving in Melbourne in 1955, the brilliant but eccentric researcher frequently went bush, studying child development among the Aboriginals and collecting blood serum for several Australian research labs. Gajdusek flew to New Guinea in 1957, and with nothing but his own meager funds to support this venture, he began working on a new problem. To a colleague in the United States, Gajdusek wrote, "I am in one of the most remote, recently opened regions of New Guinea, in the center of tribal groups of cannibals, only contacted in the last 10 years, still spearing each other as of a few days ago, and cooking and feeding the children the body of a Kuru case, the disease I am studying, only a few weeks ago." But Gajdusek had never seen any actual cannibalism, and he had very little real knowledge about Kuru. Beyond the stress-related hypothesis, there was some conjecture that the deadly condition might be the result of an environmental toxin. Others believed that Kuru was a hereditary disorder. Consequently, Gajdaszek got busy. He spent months collecting blood, feces, and urine from the locals. He ran tests on those stricken by the disease, and with the aid of translators, he conducted interviews with victims and their family members. By mid-1957, Gajdaszek was working with Vin Zegas, a medical doctor who had already been gathering information as well as his own blood samples. That November, their initial findings were published in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. Kuru, the authors claimed, was a degenerative disease of the central nervous system. They described the clinical course of the disease as well as its curious preference for striking three times as many women as men. The skewed sex ratios were difficult to pick up, however, since more men were being killed for having been Kuru's sorcerers. For the foray, ritual murder had become the great equalizer. In what would later become an important observation, Gajdaszek also noted that Kuru occurred equally in children of both sexes. The researchers sent off blood and tissue samples for analysis, but the results showed no evidence of viral infection, nor did they appear to indicate the presence of a toxin. They had suspected that the foray were possibly being poisoned by heavy metals in their diet. But a number of the tissue specimens did show something remarkable, although it was as much about what the samples lacked as what they exhibited. After examining the brains of 8 Kuru victims, scientists at the National Institute of Health, NIH, in Bethesda, Maryland, reportedly found no evidence of inflammation or any immune response. That meant the victim's body had not been fighting off a pathogenic organism like a virus, bacterium, or fungus. In most cases, at the first signs of a viral, bacterial, or fungal intruder, the body initiates a sustained, multi-pronged defense consisting of non-specific responses like swelling and inflammation, and cell-mediated responses like the production of antibodies, proteinaceous particles that bind to foreign proteins, antigens, found on foreign cells and viruses. What the investigators did find was that large regions of the cerebellum, which sits like a small head of cauliflower behind the cerebral hemispheres, were full of holes. Igor Klotso, an NIH researcher, had seen a disease like this only once before. "The closest condition I can think of," he said, "is that described by Jakob and Creutzfeldt." Another NIH scientist noted a similarity between Kuru and the transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, TSE, known as scrapie, an unusual infectious agent of sheep. Scrapie, which was present in European sheep by the beginning of the 18th century, was named for one of its symptoms, namely the compulsive scraping of the stricken animal's fleece against objects like fences or rocks. It had been previously classified as a slow virus, an archaic term for a virus with a long incubation period in which the first symptoms might not appear for months or even years after exposure. Klotso and William Hadlow, who had made the Kuru-scrapie connection, now suspected that the cause of Kuru might also be a slow virus. At this point, Ronald Berndt tried to reassert himself as the world's leading authority on the New Guinea Highlands and its indigenous inhabitants. Miffed that medical researchers were intruding on what he considered his anthropological turf, he refused to be outdone by upstarts like Gajdaszek. Berndt wrote his own article on Kuru, re-emphasizing the importance of sorcery and resurrecting the original stress-related explanation. Fear alone, Berndt claimed, was probably enough to initiate the irreversible symptoms of Kuru. Fortunately, though, in what many might argue was a strong positive step for Kuru research, Berndt and his wife refused to share their data and expertise with those who were actually doing real research on the disease. Gajdaszek, for his part, dismissed Berndt's baseless assertions, believing instead that the high occurrence of Kuru among young children argued against a psychological origin for the disease. He was leaning toward the explanation proposed by genetics professor Henry Bennett, who attempted to explain the discrepancy between male and female adults dying of kuru. Bennett proposed that a mutant kuru gene K was dominant, uppercase K, in females, but recessive, lowercase k, in males. Accordingly, only males who were KK, upper class, and who had inherited a dominant form of the gene from each parent died of kuru, while males who were either normal, KK lowercase, or carriers, uppercase K, lowercase K, were unaffected by the disease. Alternately, females who were either KK, both uppercase, or KK, uppercase and lowercase, died of kuru, while only those females who were normal, KK, lowercase, were unaffected. In the end, the fact that kuru victims included equal numbers of male and female children, but few adult males, was deeply troubling to Gajdoshek, and it raised serious questions about Bennett's gene-based disease hypothesis, which was soon abandoned. By this time, the researchers had already been dealing with another problem. This one related to the sensationalized slant the press had given the kuru story. Time magazine, for example, opened its November 11, 1957 article, The Laughing Death, with the following. In the eastern highlands of New Guinea, sudden bursts of maniacal laughter shrilled through the walls of many a circular windowless grass hut, echoing through the surrounding jungle. Sometimes, instead of the roaring laughter, there might be a fit of giggling. When a tribesman looked into such a hut, he saw no cause for merriment. The laughter was lying ill, exhausted by his guffaws, his face now an expressionless mask. He had no idea that he had laughed, let alone why. It was kuru, the laughing death, a creeping horror hitherto unknown to medicine. The Time story then went on to describe how the Foray were only now emerging from the Stone Age, and that they still practiced cannibalism and the ritual murder of kuru sorcerers, when they think they can get away with it. Even when dealing with the scientific aspects of the story, the article's anonymous author took ghoulish satisfaction in reporting Gajdoshek performed autopsies without gloves, atop the same dining room table where meals were eaten. Additionally, the article continued, the researcher had to haggle with victims' relatives for the bodies of kuru victims, and he got some bodies at the bargain price of only one axe. For his part, Gajdoshek hated the media coverage, and he considered the term laughing death to be a ludicrous misnomer. The worldwide media coverage did have at least one positive effect, in that it increased the public's awareness of the deadly problem facing the Foray. Because of this, universities began to funnel funds into kuru research, and this money helped support a new influx of professional researchers into the region. Two of the first to arrive were cultural anthropologists Robert and Shirley Glass, now Shirley Lindenbaum, who came from Australia to New Guinea on a university grant in 1961. Studying kinship among the Foray, they returned to continue their research in 1962 and 1963. Their work in the New Guinea highlands would ultimately allow them to make the connection between kuru and cannibalism. I met Dr. Shirley Lindenbaum half a century later at an Upper West Side apartment, which had been decorated with art and other memorabilia collected during a long and distinguished career. In a voice that still retained the hint of an Australian accent, she talked about her studies. "What was it that finally convinced you that cannibalism was the mode of kuru transmission?" I asked her. Lindenbaum explained that once the epidemic began in the New Guinea highlands, she and her husband were instructed to gather genealogical data about people who had kuru. In doing so, they spoke to Foray elders who had seen the first cases of the disease in their villages. They could remember these cases, and even the names of the people in the North Foray who came down with the disease some couple of decades earlier. There were these tremendously convincing first stories, and we said, "What happened to those people?" And the Foray said, "Well, they were consumed." We knew they were cannibals. I pressed on, asking Lindenbaum how she knew for sure that the Foray were cannibals. Without hesitation, she cited, fieldwork in the area by Ronald and Catherine Burnt in the 1950s, as well as government patrol reports throughout the Eastern Highlands. I may or may not have raised an eyebrow at the mention of the Burnts, but I did ask Lindenbaum if she was bothered by the fact that no anthropologist, including the Burnts, had ever seen ritualized cannibalism firsthand. "No," Lindenbaum replied, "because there are a lot of things we haven't seen firsthand, sexual intercourse among them, but there's evidence that it occurs." At this point, something like an alarm went off in my brain. Basically, this line about sexual intercourse has become something of a mantra for those anthropologists who claim that ritual cannibalism occurred in a particular group, even though they had not seen it with their own eyes. After encountering this undeniably catchy analogy several times in the literature, I became curious as to its origin. As far as I can tell, it was coined by Pulitzer Prize-winning anthropologist Jared Diamond in an article he wrote for Nature in 2000. Here's the relevant passage. "Finally, any society has practices considered acceptable in private but inappropriate to practice in public, in the presence either of anyone else, for example, sex or defecation, or of non-clan members, for example, initiation rites or cannibalism. The abundance of New Guinea babies, my knowledge that babies are conceived by sexual intercourse, and second-hand accounts persuade me that New Guineans practice sex, but I have no first-hand observations of it, even after many years there." The reason for my unease at the mention of this particular notion was based on my interview with Bill Ahrens, who eventually acknowledged a clear-cut association between cannibalism and Kuru. Still, though, he had a major problem with the cannibalism-sexual intercourse comparison. Approximately 2 seconds after asking Ahrens what he thought about Diamond's famous line, he answered my question with one of his own. "You ever been in the field with an anthropologist?" I admitted that I hadn't. "They're always screwing the natives, so they know sexual intercourse takes place." "Okay," I said, scanning the paper I had been holding for another question. Something about Ahrens' favorite ice cream flavor, perhaps. The anthropologist smiled at what I thought was some well-camouflaged discomfort on my part. "Well, I'm just telling you," he said. "You gave me the example, and it's absurd. No anthropologists should ever say that we don't know sexual intercourse takes place among those people because we've never seen it, because that's really a falsehood. They've seen it, and I know they've seen it, and if they haven't seen it, they should get a mirror." Months later, on the Upper West Side, Lindenbaum was completely unaware of my unease with what had obviously become a standard line among anthropologists studying aspects of behavior that were, for whatever reason, hard to observe. She continued with her story. "We knew cannibalism was customary in this area, but that the disease had only appeared in the last few decades. And so we thought, well, that's very interesting. When we began collecting ethnographic data about who ate whom, it became clear that it was adult women, not adult men, but children of both sexes. At that time, the director of Kuru Research in New Guinea was a guy named Richard Hornibrook, a neurologist. And he said to us, 'What is it that adult women and children do that adult men don't do?' And we said, 'Cannibalism, of course.' The epidemiological evidence matched the cultural behavior evidence, and that matched the historical origin evidence. It was such a neat package, you know?" I nodded. "So what did you do with that information?" "We told everybody," she said. "And?" "And nobody believed us." Nevertheless, Robert Glass published his and his then-wife Shirley's hypothesis that Kuru was transmitted by consuming the body parts of relatives who had died from the disease. As support, he cited the fact that women commonly participated in ritual cannibal feasts, but not men. He also wrote that children of both sexes had become infected because they accompanied their mothers to these ceremonies and participated in the consumption of contaminated tissue, including brains. Finally, Glass calculated that Kuru appeared anywhere between 4 and 24 years after the ingestion of cooked human tissue containing an unidentified pathogenic agent. Nearly 50 years after Glass published the couple's findings, anthropologist Jerome Whitfield and his colleagues used an extensive set of interviews as well as previously collected ethnohistorical data to provide a detailed description of foray mortuary rites. Whitfield told me how his research group deployed the educated young foray members of their team to conduct unstructured interviews in a sample group composed of elderly family members who had witnessed, taken part in, or were informed about traditional mortuary feasts. The interviews revealed funerary practices that ranged from burial in a basket or on a platform to the practice of transumption, a term Whitfield and some of his colleagues adopted as an alternative to using cannibalism to describe the ritual consumption of dead kin. As for how the funerary practices would be carried out, if possible, according to Whitfield, the dying person made his or her preference known. In other cases, though, the deceased's family made the call. Generally, the foray believed that it was better to be consumed by your loved ones than by maggots, and that by eating their dead, relatives could express their grief and love, receive blessings, and ensure the passage of the departed to Quellananda Mundi, the land of the dead. For these reasons, transumption was the funerary practice favored by the foray. According to those interviewed by Whitfield's team, the corpse was placed on a bed of edible leaves in order to ensure that nothing was lost on the ground, as this would have been disrespectful. The body was cut up with a bamboo knife and the parts handled by several women whose specific roles were defined by their relationships to the deceased. Pieces of meat were placed into piles to be divided up among the deceased's kin. Next, the women leading the ceremony enlisted the daughters and daughters-in-law of the deceased to cut the larger pieces of flesh into smaller strips, which were stuffed into bamboo containers with ferns and cooked over a fire. Eventually, the deceased's torso was cut open, but during this portion of the ritual, the older women formed a wall around the body to prevent younger women and children from seeing the removal of the intestines and genitals. These parts were presented to the widow if there was one. Once the flesh was cooked, it was scooped out and placed onto communal plates made of leaves. The funerary meal was shared among the dead person's female kin and their children. The head of the deceased also became part of the ritual. It was cooked over a fire to remove the hair before being defleshed with a knife. Next, the skull was cracked with a stone axe and the brain was removed. Considered to be a delicacy, the semi-gelatinous tissue was mixed with ferns, cooked, and consumed. Bones were dried by the fire, which made it easier to grind them into a powder that would be mixed with grass and heated in bamboo tubes. According to the accounts obtained by Whitfield's team, the foray ate everything, including reproductive organs and feces scraped from the intestines. Shirley Lindenbaum told me that initially, at least, members of the foray were receptive about answering questions related to kuru and cannibalism. Later, though, as more missionaries came in and journalists came through and wanted to talk to people and said, "Tell us about that," that is, cannibalism, they became very defensive and wouldn't talk to people about it. So how did kuru spread from village to village and from one region of the foray territory to another? According to Lindenbaum, kinship relations were the key. She explained that although foray women moved from their natal homes to marry men from other groups, they still maintained their kinship affiliations with their former communities. When deaths occurred, women from adjacent and nearby hamlets, who were related to the deceased persons, traveled and took part in the mortuary feasts. Similarly, individuals and families who moved into new communities maintained kinship ties with their former communities, especially on special occasions. Additionally, like other diseases throughout history, kuru traveled along well-defined trade exchange routes, in this case those connecting the villages of the New Guinea Highland. Factors like these did much to explain how kuru had spread through the villages, and additional research put a timeline on the spread. By tracing the path of the kuru reports, from the earliest to the latest, Lindenbaum and her husband calculated that the first cases of kuru occurred around the turn of the 20th century in Uwami, a village in the northwestern highlands. By 1920, Kuru had spread to the North Foray villages, and by 1930 into the region inhabited by the South Foray. Jerome Whitfield, who conducted nearly 200 interviews in the Kuru-affected region for his dissertation, believes that the practice of cannibalism in the New Guinea highlands may have begun 40 or 50 years earlier than the first cases of Kuru, which would make it sometime in the mid-19th century. Eventually, these findings became strong evidence against a genetic origin for the disease. Since there had been a genetic link, researchers would not have expected the first reports of Kuru to begin so suddenly and only 60 years earlier. Additionally, had Kuru been a genetic abnormality, in all likelihood it would have reached something known as epidemiological equilibrium, a condition in which the prevalence of a genetic disorder in a population becomes stable rather than changing over time. In this case, the glasses data indicated that, from its first appearance at the turn of the century, Kuru-related deaths had increased for the next 5 decades, peaking in the late 1950s. In 2008, Michael Alpers wrote that Kuru deaths among the Foray peaked between 1957 and 1961 with around 1,000 victims. With the prohibition of cannibalism beginning in the late 1950s, the number of Kuru deaths hit a steep decline in the 1960s and 1970s, with less than 300 deaths between 1972 and 1976. The plague was over, or so it seemed.